This, too, was myself. All human beings, as we meet them, are commingled out of good and evil. And Edward Hyde, alone in the ranks of mankind, was pure evil. Those words come from Henry Jekyll's final testimony, and they capture something of the giddy, unsettling atmosphere of Robert Louis Stevenson's strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a story so famous that its title passed into common usage within Stevenson's own lifetime. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and to explore what the story really means and what it tells us about Stevenson himself, his life, and his astonishing creative range, I'm joined by Leo Damrosch, author of Storyteller, The Life of Robert Louis Stevenson. So Leo, thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'd like to begin with structure, partly because plot mattered enormously to Stevenson. In one of his essays, he criticizes writers who think it's clever to write a novel with no story, or at least a very dull one. So perhaps we can start with the plot and with the remarkable way Stevenson deals with his raw material.
Well, if it's all right, I'd like to place it in the larger context of his other writing, because in fact, it doesn't have the kind of conventional plot, the storytelling, even adventure plot, that he very often exploited in especially his Scottish novels. And in fact, it's quite an exception to the rest of his work, although a very impressive one and well worth thinking about. He published it in 1886. In the same year, he published Kidnapped, which is an adventure story set in the Scottish Highlands 100 years before Stevenson's time that is nothing like Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was a kind of modernist before his time and always trying something new. And this was something he didn't repeat, although it is a masterpiece. Now, as to plot, well, it's only at the very end that we find out that Henry Jekyll, the respectable London physician, and Mr. Hyde, the strange, dwarfish, warped person who has some apparent hold over Jekyll, are the same person. That, in fact, Jekyll takes a potion which turns him into his evil self, and increasingly it takes over until finally he commits suicide, because otherwise there'll be nothing left but the evil one. But you find that out at the very end of the book, because the story is told in separate narrations by friends of his trying to figure out what's going on in his life and never suspecting that Jekyll and Hyde are the same person, which is one reason the movie versions, and there were quite a few, really can't do what this novella, this short novel does, because you can't help knowing from the very beginning that it's the same actor playing Jekyll and Hyde. But at the end of the novel itself, it just staggers you to discover that that was what was going on. So that's the structure of it, and a very original one.
Yeah, and I think it was the writer Borges who said, you have to think yourself, or something along these lines, that you have to think yourself into the state of mind of an early reader of this novel. Because it's become so famous, you don't quite feel that same sense of revelation that you just described.
Yes, that's right.
Stevenson himself once described Jekyll and Hyde as functioning almost like a kind of myth, one that conveys, and these are his words, life's larger limitations, and that sort of sense we seem to perceive in the arabesque of time and space. So I think he takes material that could easily lapse into the grotesque. And exactly, Leo, like in the film adaptations of Jekyll and Hyde, it loses almost all of its power because you get this kind of grotesque transformation and it just looks wrong. And the important thing about Hyde in the novel is that he's never really described directly. So there's something that feels very sober and very real about the novel and very restrained. How important is that sense of suppression and economy to the book?
Oh, it's very important indeed. In a sense, it's more like a detective story than it is like a horror story, because his friends who care for Henry Jekyll are trying to understand what strange spell he seems to have fallen under, that this peculiar, warped little individual has a key to his house and apparently has some hold over him. They wonder if it's an illegitimate son. They don't have any idea. So the narration is always very straightforward and matter-of-fact, and the narrators themselves are unimaginative, sensible people. And it makes the ending all the more startling when you suddenly rethink everything that you were reading up until then. And of course, Borges is right. Now we've all heard of a Jekyll and Hyde personality, and the cover is already blown on page one.
Yes, the phrase Jekyll and Hyde is often simply used to mean someone who is changeable, one thing one moment, another the next. But that's not quite what the story is about, is it? It's about the attempt to hive off parts of the self and the kind of moral costs of doing so.
Yeah, I might say something about the larger context of this story and Stevenson's own experience. He was brought up in an extremely pious Calvinist family in Edinburgh, and his nanny, who was a wonderful person and an important influence in his life, however, did condition him as a small child to fear eternal damnation, and he would wake up in terrifying nightmares about that. And by the time he was a young man, he had lost his faith. I certainly didn't believe that anymore. But he still had what he always called, what he took from St. Paul, the war within our members. There's always an evil self struggling to get free and take over. I think he felt that profoundly, although he was certainly, in actual life, a very lovable and trustworthy person. And this novella is his brooding about that theme, which became part of his consciousness, even though he gave up the theology that had originally grounded it.
Yes, Stevenson himself said that childhood nightmares were defined for him by the horror of infinite distance and infinite littleness. How do you think that sensation runs through the novel? And I'm thinking really here about the setting at large and in the pattern of Jekyll and Hyde's kind of intimacy.
Well, I might say something more about the genesis of this story. Stevenson had worked for a long time on trying to write a play with a good friend of his, William Ernest Henley, the well-known poet, about a character who actually existed in Edinburgh named Deacon Brodie, who was an upstanding joiner, carpenter by day, and a burglar by night. But it was just a double life. It was just the same person misbehaving secretly. And he wrote a first draft of Jekyll and Hyde that was pretty much the same idea. And his wife, Fanny, and we might talk about her later, an extraordinary person and very intelligent, his best critic, listened to him read it aloud. And she looked sort of gloomy. And she said, well, you've left out the whole moral of the thing. You've just made it one person misbehaving in his spare time. It's really two different personalities in the same individual. And he said, you're right. And he flung the manuscript into the fire, which horrified her and his stepson, and wrote the book that we have from scratch, in which exactly it's the upstanding Jekyll is increasingly taken over by the evil self he thought he was separating out so it could indulge itself briefly while he would go on being his real self. No, that his real self is a divided self, and eventually it does destroy him.
Yeah, and that brings us to the novel's moral core. I mean, again, quite like using Stevenson's own words, he was a kind of good self-critic in some ways. But he later said, I think in response to a reader, about the nature of Hyde's crimes, because there was a huge interest at the time in sort of speculating about what Hyde was up to, because it's kind of left, apart from two incidents in the novel, it's basically left kind of unclear. And I guess that brings us to the novel's moral core. I mean, Stevenson later said the harm was in Jekyll because he was a hypocrite, and the hypocrite let out the beast Hyde. So it's not this sense that it's something that, for me, comes into the deepest background of the novel, and that's Stevenson's Scottishness and the Presbyterian imagination. And he later also wrote that the book reflected both the old Scotch Presbyterian preoccupation with moral problems. It's quite hard to convey what that actually means, but maybe a quote from the Scottish Catechism can give a hint. You know, what is the whole duty of man is a kind of very characteristic element of the way Presbyterians kind of talk about our life as created beings. It's sort of heavy moral responsibility. And then he contrasts that preoccupation with moral problems with the dazzled incapacity to choose of an age of transition, this age of modernity. So how deeply, Leo, does that dual inheritance, the kind of the Calvinist and the kind of sense of the modern, run through the novel?
Well, I'd like to start by saying something about exactly what the evil is that Hyde carries out. The movie versions have all made it sexual, so there's orgies and so on. And it's certainly true that the Victorians were very hypocritical about sex, and they punished Oscar Wilde, and we know all that. Stevenson hadn't seen movies, but he had certainly seen that interpretation of his book, and he said they've got it all wrong. They think the worst thing that can happen is sexual enjoyment. What he's talking about is sadistic evil, just the desire to hurt. And the few incidents that are actually described in the book are, in fact, beating an innocent woman on the street just because it's possible, or crippling, half-killing an old man who is being perfectly friendly on the street. They're just random acts of violence. And Stevenson did repudiate the Calvinist doctrine of sin. He always said the Ten Commandments are 10 ways of saying thou shalt not, and Jesus always said what you should do. He was really not committed to the faith he was brought up in intellectually, but he thought it was right. There is this war in our members, this deep temptation in all human beings to do something bad because it's bad. And that was what he wanted to dramatize in this story. So it's not just a critique of Victorian respectability and hypocrisy, though it is that, as a critique, as you say, of not acknowledging that side of oneself, or thinking, as Dr. Jekyll does, that I can just separate it out and let it have a life of its own and I'll be a happy person the rest of the time. I think Stevenson felt deeply you can't ever separate it out, and you have to acknowledge that it's there.
Yeah, and that drives very deep into the structure of the novel. I mean, some of the creepiest moments, if creepy is the right word, involve very ordinary domestic details. Tea on a table, firelight, footsteps behind a door. There's a kind of a prelude or an aftermath to something shocking or a transformation. So it feels like Stevenson had quite a good feel for the uncanny long before Freud gives it a definition.
Yeah, and part of the Scottish folk tradition that fascinated him, and some of his very best short stories are based on it, are about what bogies, which was not the sort of frivolous way that term is used now, but frightening spirits of evil, or even the Prince of Darkness himself appearing in disguise. He has that in several of his stories. But this is evil without the Christian doctrine to explain it. It's just evil as part of human nature.
Yeah, so I mean, that also connects to the book's kind of dual nature, that it is framed as a case history, much like many of the medical case histories that people read at the time and were quite popular, but it unfolds in the structure of a dream state and a nightmare. How does that work in the novel?
Yeah, I think the medical analogy is good. Publishers often misrepresent it by calling it the strange case, which would be like one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, which had not yet begun to appear. But it's a peculiar case study of a psychological deformation. That's right. And the nightmarish quality grows on you because, as I'll repeat, because his perfectly sensible conventional friends are trying to make out what's going on. So it's not like it's full of horror, but deep down it is a horror story.
Yeah, I mean, Stevenson himself insisted that parts of the story actually came to him in dreams. How seriously should we take that?
Oh, that happened more than once in his life. Yes, it did. And what happened in this case is his wife Fanny woke him because he was having a frightening nightmare and she wanted to shake him out of it. And he said, "Why did you wake me up? I was having the most wonderful bogey dream." And he had actually imagined scenes that get into the novel when he ends up writing it before he knew what they were for. I think some of his best work came, we would now say, from the unconscious, and he was very frank about that.
But then, I mean, doubleness is clearly something that preoccupies Stevenson. I think he wrote that he'd long been trying to find a body or a vehicle for his sense of man's double being. How does that, the doubleness, play out in the other novels? I mean, there are in some of the short stories, especially Markheim, which is actually a kind of Christmas short story, which is about a kind of shocking murder in an antique store. And then it's about a man who's a murderer who ultimately finds a kind of grace through being confronted by a kind of angel or a second self. So doubleness does seem to emerge in many other of his texts. I'm also thinking of Kidnapped, where, you know, you do have this strong sense of there's the highlands and the lowlands. There's a sense of Scotland as a kind of fractured society, and one in which that, you know, the modern subject, the modern Scot, is estranged in some way from kind of the primitive past. And that denial of his primitive past or of the emotional side creates a kind of fracturing in the self. So, yeah, how does doubleness play out elsewhere?
Well, I think, and you've mentioned good examples, because many of his short stories are quite wonderful, and they've been neglected. Markheim is certainly a very good one. They're all different from each other. He's a very experimental writer. So there are many forms of doubleness, and the kind you mentioned in Kidnapped, which really is a masterpiece, and it's not just a book for boys, as people used to think. It's a book about, indeed, a young narrator, not just growing up, but finding out who he is and who he can trust and how to understand the world. It's a very rich theme. The doubleness there, as you say, is cultural, the highlands and the lowlands, and also historical, because it's set 100 years before Stevenson's own time, really when the highlands were still very much a kind of independent culture and not been fully assimilated at all. And in many ways, he did not feel he belonged in Edinburgh, but middle class, professionalized, bonded with England to the south. He had a romantic feeling for the Highlands. So that's one kind of doubleness, but I don't think you get it in the characters themselves. But there's another Scottish novel, a kind of mixed success, but it has wonderful things in it, called The Master of Ballantrae, which is really about two brothers who are like Cain and Abel characters. And there are two sides of this traditional Scottish self, divided into two characters who are all too involved with each other. So that's another way of doing it. I think Jekyll and Hyde is the only example of literal doubleness in the same individual. And probably you couldn't write many stories doing exactly that.
Yeah, but the genius is that it's in the same individual, but then it's hived off, isn't it? So Hyde then can become the kind of screen on which you can project any theme you like, I think. I think that's the great... So I think there's a comparison with Kafka's Metamorphosis, that because the kind of nature of the allegory, it's done with such precision and economy and almost blankness at times, it becomes something which you can sort of project any theme you like. And I think that's why Jekyll and Hyde has been read and reread by so many. I mean, it's been interpreted in a sort of wildly florid number of kind of modern intellectual traditions. You know, the gender reading, there's the Victorian morality reading, there's sort of endless thematic registers you can kind of project onto it.
Yeah, although, of course, Hyde isn't really hived off. That's what Jekyll's thought would happen. But of course, Hyde is Jekyll. So it's his own worst self acting out the impulses that he would normally try to repress.
Yeah, this too was myself. I think that's the most chilling sentence. You know, this too is myself. Just that kind of moment of recognition. Yeah, I mean, can talk a little bit about the setting in general. I mean, I know it's set in London, but it's a novel that's certainly haunted by a sense of Edinburgh, which was Stevenson's childhood home, and somewhere, you know, Edinburgh and Scotland always seem to pervade almost all his writing, even when he moved far away. And we can talk a bit later about how his life develops. But, you know, one of the most kind of Jekyll and Hydean pieces of culture I've seen in the last century is Danny Boyle's Shallow Grave from 1995. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
It's a film set in Edinburgh's New Town, incidentally only a few hundred yards from Stevenson's childhood home. And it follows a group of apparently decent professional flatmates who take in a new tenant, and he turns up dead with a suitcase full of cash. And they all decide to dispose of the body and keep the money. And they sort of make a deal that they're never going to tell anyone. And one character in particular, who's called David Stevens, who's an accountant, who's played quite brilliantly by Christopher Eccleston, has a really distinctly Jekyll-like role. He's kind of dry and moral and faintly superior. And I think in Jekyll and Hyde, Jekyll is described as having a face, kind of sort of slightly hypocritical face, or kind of something a bit off about it. And he's ultimately driven mad because he's the one who takes on disposing the body. So he's the kind of the character who thinks himself as the most good. There's a kind of trio, and he is pulled into this kind of nightmare world, and it sends him mad. And the film unconsciously, and I'm sure consciously, pulls together a lot of elements that would have been in Stevenson's imaginative world. You know, Edinburgh as a leading medical centre, with dissection a key part of that. Jekyll's cabinet in the text is above a former anatomy theatre. And then there's things like the legacy of Burke and Hare. You know, it's Edinburgh is a city where there's, you know, the cutting edge science on the one hand, and it depends on people who rob graves. So it's kind of this balancing of the grotesque and the most highly modern things that would have been around. It's a kind of interesting setting because it's London, but it's very much through the prism, I think, of the kind of doubleness that Stevenson ascribed to his own hometown.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know if anybody has figured out why he did set it in London. He didn't have to. I think what interested him, he never felt comfortable in London, was the hugeness and easily achieved anonymity of this vast city with all its, you know, shadows and dark places that novelists had always written about. So I think he liked the idea of the upstanding, cultivated physician in this sort of labyrinth of the London underworld. And maybe Edinburgh was too familiar and too much home for him to have set it there.
Yes, because it sort of dives between smart bits of the West End, like Mayfair and Soho, which is very different and described in very different terms. And yeah, I mean, G.K. Chesterton, 1927, comments that there's something decidedly Caledonian about Dr. Jekyll. And I think that's true of the structure as well. All the characters, in some way, I think, reflect elements of the kind of preeminent professional class in Edinburgh. It's the lawyer, who's Utterson, who's the main character, the doctor. They're sort of well-educated professional men. And it's their kind of sociability and their interactions that kind of drive the novel. Yeah, Stevenson himself was like oddly dismissive of it. I mean, he called it the worst thing I ever wrote. But then you sort of get the impression that he was quite proud of it years later.
He can't have believed that.
No,
yeah.
But if we take that seriously, that he thought there was something wrong with it, why would he say that?
Well, this is just my guess, but I think he was shocked that so many conventional moralists, many, many preachers, seized upon it and said, yes, that's what we're talking about from our pulpit. That's the, you know, the appeal of sin. And I tried to say earlier in our conversation, I don't think Stevenson wanted to use the word sin, which is breaking commandments, and you go to everlasting damnation if you don't repent. He was brought up that way, and he didn't believe it. So what he believes is something much deeper. And when people would write to him and say, I'm not sure I understand exactly what the moral of Jekyll and Hyde is, he would write back and say, it's the words I wrote. I'm not going to add anything to it. It's not really an allegory where you say, yes, the Red Cross Knight and the Fairy Queen is really the Christian warrior. Mm. It's full of questions and not answers, and he wanted to leave it that way.
I quoted it earlier, but that sense of life's larger limitations, which I think is quite a humane way of putting it. That brings me on to, I mean, where do you think Jekyll and Hyde sits in the history of the novel in English? I mean, I quite like the idea, this is, I think, the critic Gilbert Ryle's idea, that English fiction, you know, either follows this kind of Calvinist pattern, there's a sin or you escape the sin, or more of an Aristotelian one, where characters tend to differ in degree. And Stevenson, well, there's a kind of sense, a kind of humane sense that people make mistakes, and there's not really a message attached to that. And Stevenson seems to sort of combine the two. And there's a parallel that sits in my head between Robinson Crusoe and Jekyll, that Crusoe is the agent of the successful written self, you know, the author of a providential history that takes his sins and makes them meaningful through sort of kind of writing them out. Whereas Jekyll, in his account, and the last 15 pages of the book, or last 10 pages of the book, are Jekyll, in Jekyll's words, his description of what's happened. In his accounts, he kind of writes himself into oblivion. It's like the written self is an agent of his kind of ultimate disintegration. And there's these very haunting moments where he describes himself being in Hyde's skin, Hyde's in the Hyde you know, transformation, but he's still able to write. So he's still able to use Jekyll's hand and mimic Jekyll's hand. So it's like the Hyde self can betray, you know, the written self Jekyll tries to maintain, or can mimic it effectively. So, yeah, I mean, where do you think Jekyll and Hyde sits in that kind of picture?
Well, there are a number of issues there. One specific one I should mention is the concept or the gimmick is that when Jekyll drinks this potion, which he has learned how to create, then he becomes Hyde. And what's happening at the end, as you say, is that the Hyde self increasingly is not separate and is beginning to take over and is indeed writing with his hand. And it's a last-ditch attempt to explain himself that he writes this document that he leaves upon his suicide. But I would not, again, use the word sin. And it's true that Defoe did. Robinson Crusoe is about being put on a desert island because of your sinfulness and then ultimately rewarded because of a religious conversion. But I think critics have always seen that that is an absolute fantasy, that nobody believes that Crusoe is a sinner. He doesn't do anything particularly bad, and he doesn't seem particularly, you know, wounded by his sinfulness. But he, in fact, ends up unbelievably rich, and everything worked out great. And the desert island, far from being a kind of prison, is a liberation from competition with other people. And he can have a bunch of animals as his associates and be king of his little world. So I don't think Defoe understood his novel at all. He thought it was a religious allegory, and nobody believes that today. And Stevenson was not writing a religious allegory. He'd had enough of those in his upbringing. Mm-hmm. He was writing about something much more profound, which is like Greek tragedy or something like that.
Yeah. But I think that's what runs through Jekyll's account. It's full of religious imagery. It's full of Old Testament quotations.
Yeah. And Stevenson, in his letters, he quotes the Bible all his life. It's not that he's being pious.
Yeah, exactly. But it's Jekyll's, I think that's where the profound hypocrisy starts to emerge, that Jekyll, I think he sort of wants his story to be one of God coming to get him because he's sinned so hard. But then there's the vanity that comes with that, that he also feels he's the kind of Promethean figure, that he's done something that no one else has done. And I think it's a novel built from different accounts of what has happened by different people. And I think Stevenson is clearly gesturing to the reader, you know, read this pretty critically, especially the Jekyll account at the end.
Yeah, and when you, at the beginning of our conversation, talked about hypocrisy, I think that's right, that Jekyll probably doesn't acknowledge how much he does have sadistic, cruel impulses. So in liberating the Hyde side of himself by drinking that potion, he doesn't foresee or understand how appalling the behavior is going to be. But it is, as you've said all along, that's still himself. It's a part of himself that's now got free expression. And if he were less of a hypocrite, he would have known all along that he has these impulses and wishes that he needs to dominate because they are destructive.
Yeah, and we should now talk about Stevenson's life and his world. It certainly wouldn't do him justice to confine ourselves to Jekyll and Hyde. And it's a great shame about Stevenson that people, I think, tend to, if I were to say to a man on the street, I was doing a podcast about Robert Louis Stevenson, they'd say, oh, I read Treasure Island when I was 10. And I know that Jekyll and Hyde exists somewhere beyond that. I think it would be rare to find someone who went further than that. So, yeah, what are the other themes in his life? Where is he at the moment when he's writing this? How does his wife, I think at that point they were pretty recently married, how does she help him with his composition? How did she improve his writing? How did the kind of pattern of his life in which Jekyll and Hyde became a reality and was published, how did that change over time, and how did that transform into other things?
Well, I've already said he was always experimenting. He was like a modernist before the time of the modernists. He wrote this novel in Bournemouth, which was then a health resort in the south coast of England, because he had a lifelong, very dangerous hereditary lung condition. It was not tuberculosis that was eventually proved, but he could have easily died of terrible hemorrhages. And he was basically an invalid during the 3 years that he lived in Bournemouth. And his best friend there was a completely different kind of writer, but they become fans of each other's work. And that was Henry James, who wrote the kind of novel you mentioned, which is gradual learning about social relationships and fine details of everyday life, the very opposite of Stevenson's adventure stories. And I think they liked each other's work because it was so different, but they were both artists. They could see we're both creating something with words that is remarkable, which was perfectly true. But this is only an episode in a quite adventurous life. In spite of the ill health, he traveled whenever he could. He bonded with France as a young man. He lived in an artist colony near Paris. Never felt at home in Edinburgh, really, because he was like a bad sheep there. Didn't like England. And when he was in France, he met his wife, a very free-spirited American who had lived for years in mining towns in the western United States and was a crack shot with a pistol. And she was married at the time, but disentangling from her husband. And it was a love match. People who knew them said this was a grand passion. They just adored each other. And she was his best critic. Dickens wrote a story called The Cricket on the Hearth. And Stevenson always called Fanny my critic on the hearth. And as I mentioned, she provoked him to throw the manuscript of Jekyll and Hyde into the fire. But she always wanted more energy, more clarity, more sense of kinetic forward movement. And she encouraged that in him. And I think her influence on all of his novels was very great. But just to briefly conclude the story, as his health began to recover, so they moved to the United States, then they moved to the Pacific. By then, he'd made money from his books. They rented a yacht, 100-foot-long yacht with its own captain and crew, sailed all over the Pacific, bought a plantation in Samoa, and spent the last 4 years of his life there, became a champion of the independence that the Samoan people were seeking in an age of imperialism. Quite extraordinary story of his life. And died at 44 of a stroke. He'd been a lifelong smoker, and that's probably what killed him.
Yeah. I mean, just to pass that out a bit, one of the contemporary reviewers of Jekyll and Hyde said that he had weighed his words and turned his sentences. And I think that's a very acute comment on Stevenson's other work, especially his essays, which certainly are much less read now than they were at the time. And I think I've got a bit of a theory about Stevenson. And he could read French very well, and he could speak in a kind of manner, in a kind of colloquial manner, because he spent a lot of time in France traveling around. And he wrote some lovely, probably one of his most famous other books is his narration of his journey on a donkey through the south of France. But I think that because he was good at reading in French, he had just such a good feel for how those words that we have that are cognate with French but mean, you know, these kind of false friends we have in English, their specific feeling in both languages. And that means when he's using them, he uses it with a great sense of like, this is the meaning I'm going to wring out of this word, and this is how it connects with others. Yeah, I think his interest in France and his interest in French literature, because he's quite an obsessive reader of people like Montaigne and of the new poetry, Baudelaire. But yeah, I wondered what your thoughts on that were.
Well, I think French culture and indeed the style of French writing did appeal very keenly to him. I think he liked the clarity and the shaping, but he always loved to shape language. And one of the things his nanny, Alison Cunningham, did give him was a love of the King James Bible. And he internalized that rich evocative language, which was not the language of Victorian England. And he loved stories. And there's a wonderful story when he was a very small boy. He'd misbehaved in some minor way. And his nanny told him to go stand in the corner for 10 minutes. And then she called to him and said, the 10 minutes is up. You can come out now. He said, oh, don't disturb me. I'm telling myself a story. And the reason I called my biography Storyteller is that was the name the Samoan people gave him. Tusitala in their language means storyteller. And what he wanted from a story was energy and forward movement and no wasted effort. And he once said, oh God, if I only knew the art to omit. And he loved revising his work, because the revision was when you take out all the unnecessary things and clarify things. He was very gifted at that. So it was not just his love of French, although that was very real. It was his sense of a kind of narrative energy, which we certainly feel if you ever do reread as an adult Treasure Island or Kidnapped, you just have to keep turning the page, because you're always on a kind of knife edge of what is going to happen next. So it's more than just language. It's language used as a propulsive drive to the story.
Yeah, direction and drive. Could you talk a little bit about his family background? Because he comes from quite a famous family in Scottish life, but for quite other reasons.
They were known as the Lighthouse Stevensons because at the time when his grandfather became a civil engineer, there were no lighthouses on the entire rocky Scottish coast, which was a death trap in the days of sailing ships and sudden storms. There was only one lighthouse at that time in the British Isles, which was the famous Eddystone Light off the south of England. And his family built several dozen lighthouses, most of which are still standing up and down both sides of Scotland. And it was a noble profession. It was a public service. He was brought up with every expectation that he would follow his father into the family firm. And he was incompetent at mathematics, almost ludicrously unable to do that. So his father admitted that it's just not going to work and told him, you better go to law school so you can at least support yourself. And he actually did pass the bar after studying law at the University of Edinburgh and never practiced for 1 minute because his vocation was to be a writer. And all his life, he felt a kind of shame. My family have built these lasting monuments in our country, and all I've done is scribble things on paper.
It reminds me of, again, to mention Kafka, when he talks about him, he says, I'm paper thin, I'm this paper man. And it's just like the haunting phrase. Yeah, I'm really struck by it. Right towards the end of his life, Stevenson, after he had a huge amount of professional success, still said things, well, you know, I'm nothing like, my forefathers are much more important than me. And I think that's a nice quality of Stevenson, in that he was also aware of the limitations of the written words. You know, I think he says somewhere in his essays, you know, ultimately books are a pale imitation of life. And he had this great emphasis on, as you say, direction, energy. And that is how he lived as well, despite of how outrageously ill he was. And what I really liked about your biography is I feel sometimes, I've read a few biographies of Stevenson, which at times feel a little bit like a doctor's report, because every three pages there's some sort of diabolically horrible medical problem he has. And you sort of feel like he's always just about to sort of fall over and have to stay in bed for 6 weeks. But that comes across in your book as well, because that is what happened. But it's the use he made of the time he had that comes across.
It's a good example of that. When he was living in France, early in his marriage to Fanny, and was having a very serious health crisis, and doctors told him he might actually burst an artery in his chest if he didn't lie perfectly still in bed. But he was allowed to have a slate tablet that he could scribble on. And that's when he wrote A Child's Garden of Verses, which are these very evocative poems about, well, Henry James said they're poems a child would write if a child could see childhood from the outside. I mean, they're by a man in his 30s, but it's not condescending. It's not looking down at children the way Victorian writers did. It's being a child again, imaginatively receiving all the things that the world is. And that's what he did. He would turn his disability into an opportunity to do something wonderful.
That's a really lovely quote, because it's something that my father said to me recently, that for him, the Child's Garden of Verses just simply was my childhood. You know, it just is so evocative.
That's beautiful.
So he leads this somewhat peripatetic existence, Stevenson. And as you say, I think he's quite conscious of, in his 20s, he's sort of fairly bohemian, slums around. He does pass the bar, but then doesn't go on to practice because his heart is on writing. At what point does Stevenson have the kind of professional success that allows him to support himself? And how does that change? Because up to that point, he's still supported by family money and by his father. How does that change him?
Yeah, he was very fortunate that way. And friends of his, like William Ernest Henley, though they were very loyal friends, grasped that he could always be bailed out if he happened to overspend and needed to be rescued, and they couldn't. And Henley, who was really a very talented poet, wasted his life as a editor grinding out little essays and publishing other people's work. So he did have that sense of privilege. But at the same time, it turned out that there was a public for his writing, and all of a sudden he became a bestseller to his own amazement after a decade of being totally supported by his family. And by the time he went to America in the sort of last 10 years of his life, he was hailed as a great writer, and the copyright laws had been relaxed, and suddenly he got enormous royalties, and that's how he could charter the yacht and so on. But it, in a strange sense, it never felt like a career to him. It was more like a vocation. You do something because you love it. And in those final years in the Pacific, he wrote less, and what he did write was about the Pacific, and his friends back in England said, "You're throwing yourself away." And Henry James, though a wonderful friend, said, "How can you reproach him? He's finally really living his life," and admired him for it. And in those Samoan years, he once wrote a little self-description. He said, "There are three things he loved most in the world. They were books and women and adventure." And people whispered he loved, of all those, adventure the most.
That's right. And I think we can finish on that period in his life, because there is that criticism of Stevenson that he sort of slums it a bit. You know, he wants the taste of life without the kind of bitter cost. And it sort of happens several times. He has these sort of slight scrapes because he kind of wants to live this bohemian existence. But it's a bit like the Pulp Common People song. You know, you can always ring up your dad, you know, with the roaches on the wall. You know, you can always end it all just like that. But that period in the end of his short life, when he sails into the Pacific with Fanny and his kind of entourage and his time on Samoa, yeah, just take us into that. He does become almost a major, well, you know, relatively significant player in some of the imperial politics of the time. And how did the islanders react to him, this kind of incredibly eccentric character?
They adored him as their champion, and they were right to do so. He and his family all learned the Samoan language. There were missionaries who did, and he ended up respecting them very deeply. But the colonial powers, and there were three of them there competing for the Pacific Islands, there were consulates for England and the United States and Germany, all in the very small town of Apia in Samoa. And to them, it was just territory to exploit and, if possible, to bring into their sphere of influence. And Stevenson fought for the freedom of the Samoan people. And one biographer, I won't mention the name, really offended me by complaining that he was a great white father who had an estate and he had over a dozen Samoan servants and he was lording it over them. That was so not the case. He had been told, "The Samoan people are self-sufficient. They won't come do a job they don't want to do for money. You have to make them feel they're part of a family, and they're used to bonding with the chief of..." Apparently, it was almost like the old Scottish clans. He became the clan chieftain for his people in Samoa, and they adored him, and they built a whole road for him. The chiefs built a road with their own hands, where they never did manual labor, to thank him for his role in trying to get them their freedom. And when he died, they buried him with great ceremony and honored his memory. So, in fact, it was, though his English friends said, "You're wasting your time there. You should be here in London writing proper Victorian novels." Mm. He felt like he was finally doing something in the world the way his ancestors had done.
Yeah. What did they call it? The Road of Love.
That's what they called it, yeah, in a Samoan language. A road up to this mountainside house that he had built for himself, where he had this little plantation, because until then you could only get up there on horseback, and this was more of a little highway. And they, the Road of Love, they built it for him.
And that, what was their, you say it's storyteller, what was that in Samoan?
I don't remember the Samoan word. Tusitala, yes, it's Tusitala.
Yeah, Tusitala, yeah.
Yes.
I remember reading his novels as a teenager, especially just absolutely adoring Kidnapped. And kind of reading it out without much context about his actual life, because I just never read a biography or anything like that. And then I remember going on Wikipedia and seeing that he died in Samoa and just being completely thrown by that. But in the end, he did live the kind of romantic life he always wanted. And, you know, he died at the age of 44. How did he die? It was pretty sad. He was still working on what people claim may well have been his masterpiece, The Weir of Hermiston. And he was working on it pretty furiously in the lead up, in the weeks before his death, a novel that returns us back to the setting of Lowland Scotland, even when he was sunning himself in the middle of the Pacific. So he died young, but it's right that he was always pretty conscious of the facts, or had a kind of foreboding that he was going to die at a fairly young age. And I think was pretty philosophical about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a constant expectation of death. Lawrence Sterne, who wrote Tristram Shandy in the 18th century, has a passage in that novel where the character representing Sterne, who was dying of tuberculosis, for which there was no cure, answers the door, and it's the Grim Reaper with his sickle. And then he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's the wrong address. I was going somewhere else," and lets him off that time. But, you know, next time it'll be me. And what did surprise him during the moment when he felt it was happening was the stroke. As I mentioned earlier, I think it was the chain smoking. Nobody understood how dangerous that would have been. All his life, he said, I always am smoking a cigarette except when coughing or kissing. And in a way, it was a quick and appropriate death because he didn't have to suffer horribly at the end. And Henry James, who's such a wonderful person, as you get to know him through Stevenson, wrote a beautiful letter of consolation to his widow, Fanny. And she said, of course, he's died far too young and there was so much more he could have done, but at least he had such a rounded, achieved life and you got to live with this wonderful spirit. Nobody can understand what you must be suffering now, but you've had that gift. And I think there is a kind of appropriateness to the, not that it's ever good to die, but that he really had lived a very full life by the age of 44.
Yeah, and that's a lovely quote from James. I think a pretty appropriate place to halt. Well, thanks, Leo. That was really fascinating. And your book is a wonderful tribute to a writer who, probably still is pretty underrated. And hopefully your book has done something to shift that. I mean, how I'd like to end is just to give our listeners a sense of where you'd start. If you've never read any Stevenson, how would you start a kind of little reading list of his work?
Well, I probably would start with Kidnapped, and I would follow it with the less-known sequel called Catriona. Those are the two great Scottish novels, and they're very rich, and they give you a lot that you would be surprised by. And if you have read Kidnapped long ago, well, it will be different when you read it as an adult.
Yeah, Kidnapped is an absolutely fantastic read and a real page-turner. And I would recommend, if people are going to read Jekyll and Hyde and haven't read it before, is to read it in one sitting, because it does reflect on how the craft Stevenson had as a writer. He just had a real unerring mastery for the written word. And that's the same with Kidnapped. It's probably worth reading in just a few sittings if you've got the time. Anyway, Leo, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you again.